Open House Judiciary Committee. Can you take the roll call, please?
Yes. Chair Usher.
Here.
Vice Chair Aguirre.
Here.
Vice Chair Kelker.
Here.
Representative Burgley.
Here.
Representative Bishop.
Here.
Representative Carlson.
Here.
Representative Ferris Olson.
Here.
Representative Fleming.
Here.
Representative France.
Here.
Representative Gillette.
Here.
Representative Hawk.
Here.
Representative Hinkle.
Here.
Representative Lenz.
Here.
Representative Lear.
Here.
Representative Phelan.
Here.
Representative Skies.
Here.
Representative Staffman.
Here.
Representative Stromswald.
Here.
Representative Tenenbaum.
Here.
Thank you. A couple of administrative things that we didn't talk about the other day. One, we're going to try and do these two screens, and actually I asked if we could move that down a little bit so the people farther down and or turn it a little bit. And once we get going, I'll get up and do that if none of the IT people come. That way the people that in the back, like Representative Lentz, can actually see the screen. We are still working on trying to get the cameras so the person at the podium is able to be seen by everybody that's remote. Representative Stromwald, in your packet, you probably found a whole bunch of stuff. Her packet was the only one that was in the other room, and several of you did not get some of the handouts that were left at your table, and your packets weren't there. So instead of letting them throw it away, I wanted to make sure anybody got them. So Representative Stromwald has those, and I think I put their names on them. Hopefully we can get them around. Talked about the two screens, and then one thing that came up is I wanted to remind everybody for amendments. We have the 24-hour rule. If you have an amendment on a bill that we're going to executive or planning on going to executive, make sure you give Rachel or whatever bill writer you're going to request 24 hours notice. They typically during session do work weekends, but if we can, let's try not to bother them on Sundays. So if you have something that's coming on a Monday, try and get to them at least on Saturday, mid-morning at the latest. I'd like to make sure they've got their own stuff to do, and for us to throw something at them, we need to adhere to that 24-hour. If it's something that you think we need to hold up executive on, get with me. And you're going to have to, one, convince me to postpone it, or the next opportunity will be on the floor for your amendment. With that said, I had a couple of the freshmen ask questions on how to read this bill with the crossed out lines and the underlines. And so Rachel was going to take a couple minutes to explain that.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, committee members. Good morning. Is everyone in the room and on Zoom hearing me okay?
Yes, ma'am.
Yep. Okay. So I'm going to look, if you don't mind, I'll look at House Bill 124, which you'll be hearing this morning. And I'm doing that because it has examples of a new section of law being suggested, and then also it proposes amendments to existing law. So if you look at House Bill 124, the first page on line 11, you see all caps, new section, and then a section number. That's your cue that this is all brand new language that the bill is proposing. If you flip to the second page, starting on line 1, you're going to see section 2, and then also you'll see a reference to section 45-8-343, and that is your cue that this is an existing section of law. It's already in the MCAs. And what this bill proposes to do is simply make some changes to that. Those changes you'll see starting on line 2 are going to be underlined. So this bill would add a reference to that new section 1, which you saw on page 1. And then it makes on line three kind of a grammatical change where it strikes every and inserts a. So let's try and find a strike here, or more of a strike. So it looks to me like that's the only page two, line three is the only strike in the bill. But every time a bill proposes to remove existing law, you're going to see that strike. We call it the stricken language. And then any time that you see underlined, that is new language. So this bill is mostly adding new language. Then if you flip to page eight, which is the last part of the bill, you'll see new section six, which starts page eight, line 11. And that's a codification instruction. This is kind of a little bit inside baseball if you're new, but it's also important. This section is telling you where the new part of law would be placed. If you were to pass this into law and it would be signed by the governor, that new section one would be placed in Title 87, which is Fish and Wildlife, and there are additional instructions about specifically where in that MCA title. That's important because the location of a new section can affect any penalties for a violation of the section. It can also affect the definitions that apply to that new section. So with that, Chair Escher, is there anything else you wanted me to go over or
any questions? Does anybody have any quick questions about that? No, thank you, Rachel. Appreciate
it. Okay, you're welcome.
A couple other things. Snack and water area to be in past sessions. I noticed that several people will congregate in that area during bills or whatever. To be respectful for those people and social distance a little bit. You know, if you see somebody up there getting something, wait till they walk away before you get up and go up and get the snacks. Just out of respect. Every day I will do order the bills. The bill, we usually try and talk to the bill sponsors to see if they have any conflicts with any other committees. So we'll do whatever order is up there and then get make sure it's okay with the bill sponsors. Want to remind everybody to mute or put your cell phones on vibrate. If you need to take a call, please go out in the room. If you need to have a conversation with somebody, please go out in the room or out of the room. And lastly, as we talked about last week, our Zoom manager was only going to be with us last week, so wanted to welcome Ms. Haley Swain. I hope I pronounced that correctly the first time, but you'll see her up on the screen. So if everybody could welcome her, that would be appreciated. Anyway, let's move on, and let's... Representative Ferris Olson, I assume you're ready. So we'll open the hearing.
I am, Mr. Chair.
We'll open the hearing for House Bill 91. Representative Ferris Olson, would you like to open on your bill?
I would. Thank you. Mr. Chair and members of the committee, House Bill 91 is a bill that came out of the Law and Justice Interim Committee, and it deals with the violent offender registry list. So right now, if you commit one of a number of enumerated offenses that are like deliberate homicide, aggravated assault, all those kind of pretty heinous crimes, you're required to register on the violent offender registry list. And that requirement lasts for 10 years. And once that 10 years passes, you can petition the district court to be relieved of that requirement to register. And the district court has to grant that unless you've been charged with a felony during that 10 years or even charged with failing to register or convicted. And so this bill just eliminates that ministerial portion of petitioning the district court. We passed this out of committee, I think, on September 14th, 2020. And then just a few weeks later, the Montana Supreme Court heard a very similar issue in State versus Sedler. And the court pointed out that this is just a ministerial task, this petitioning to register, because it's removal is, or the relief of the obligation to register is mandatory. And the court noted specifically that it was unconstitutional because it was an unreasonable, arbitrary, and capricious procedural roadblock, which needlessly extends an offender's registration and inappropriately subjects an offender to prosecution for failure to register during the extended time. And so this bill suddenly just became basically a cleanup bill codifying what the Montana Supreme Court had said. But it does go slightly beyond that. It also looks backward and vacates those convictions for people that failed to register after the 10 years had elapsed and expunges their record solely in relation to that crime. And that's important because some of those people may have spent up to 5 years in jail and paid up to $10,000 in fines. So it just makes the Supreme Court's decision retroactive, which hopefully alleviates some potential caseload or increases judicial efficiency because now people aren't petitioning for this exact same kind of thing. And so, again, this is just a cleanup bill at this point. And so I'd urge you all to support House Bill 91. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Ferris Olson. Wanted to move on to proponents and opponents. And it looks like, unless Ms. Swain sees anybody else, I don't see anyone online. And right now we have one opponent and three proponents in person. So before you, when you come up, please state and spell your name, who you represent for the record. If you have any exhibits or written testimony, please give those to the secretary or give them to the representative then, and they will pass them up. Please don't just read what you're going to submit. If you're going to submit written testimony. Anyway, let's start off with proponents. Proponents for House Bill 91.
Chairman Usher, members of the committee, my name is Sam Forstag, SAMFORSTAG, and I'm here on behalf of the American Civil Liberties Union of Montana. We stand in support of House Bill 91, which provides a sensible timeline for reentry into society after an individual has served their debt and time. It's a common sense cleanup bill, as the sponsor noted, and we thank the sponsor and the interim committee for their time and work putting this bill together. Thank you for your time. I stand ready for questions if necessary.
Thank you. Further proponents?
Morning. My name is Lonnie Hubbard. It's LONNIEHUBBARD. I'm in for representing or in support of this bill. I'm a felon and a violent offender as of today, and I'm here to support it. And I changed a lot of my life, and in the last 2 years I got my associates in science while holding a 3.7 GPA and became a captain at Baxendale Fire Department. And my original charge was arson, and I see the irony in that. And I got a failure to register as a violent offender when I was 18 or 20. I moved out of my parents' house, and I didn't know you could register as a transient. And so I didn't tell my probation officer that I had moved out, and then I got charged with a failure to register as a violent offender. And so that means I'd have to register for the rest of my life. And I saw this bill and I thought I'd come here and support it. Thanks. That's all I got.
Thank you, Mr. Hubbard. For those that are remote that are wishing to participate, please put your hand up. *9. You can put your hand up. We're not seeing any at this time. Go ahead, sir.
Morning, Chairman. It's kind of interesting. I'm here as a proponent of the bill. I saw a little talk Representative Skies did this morning on how we need to find some common ground as citizens of Montana, and I actually actively canvassed for...
Can you state...
Conrad Everts, last name spelled E-V-A-R-T-S.
Continue.
So anyhow, I actively campaigned for Olson's opponent leading up to the election, and here I am a proponent of one of his bills. I'd like to make sure Lonnie's not... He's not regular here, so he wrote a really good letter that'll be introduced as for all of you to read later, because he was asked not to read it. But Lonnie and I have been friends for a long time, and he's one of the most reliable human beings I know. And as he said, he does serve on the Baxendale Fire Volunteer Fire Department. The idea that he would be on this list indefinitely for essentially a clerical error when he was a kid really doesn't help him or other men and women like him become productive members of society, which is the goal of the Department of Corrections. I'm here because on the other side of this issue, I bought property a number of years ago adjacent to somebody who was on the Violent Offender Registry. And this person assaulted myself, members of my family, etc. And each time Leo Dutton's, if you're not from Lewis and Clark County, he's our sheriff, his deputies came down to the property. They handled this individual. His name was Shane White. He was murdered 2 years ago down by a cave gulch. Just a bad dude to the core. Just a bad dude to the core on the Violent Offender Registry. And near as I could tell, it in no way impacted how Dutton's office interacted or dealt with this continued violent offender. So on one side, this damages good people like Lonnie, and on the other side, it leads to no positive outcome for people like me that are just trying to run a business in Lewis and Clark County. So those are the two reasons why I'm a proponent of this.
Thank you, sir. Are there any further proponents? Proponents? I'm not seeing any remote. We'll move on to opponents. Opponents?
Morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. Alan Doane, D-O-A-N-E, here for the Montana Department of Justice. Mr. Chairman, with your permission, I have a handout.
Yes. Please pass it on to Representative Lentz.
All right, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Attorney General Knutson's primary focus is the safety of Montanans, and we do not believe that this bill is in line with that focus. If we look on the first proposed change, page 1, line 14, a violent offender required to register under this part. This list that I passed out goes to 4623502, and it lists out what violent offenses are. And I copied and pasted them on there, the titles of it, so you can look those up if you need to. Under current law, the burden is on the offender to petition the court. If that was taken away under this bill, all the burden would go to Montana Department of Justice. If you look on page 3, you can see where that burden is passed on to the Montana Department of Justice. For those people that have turned their lives around, like one of the earlier proponents talked about, if you look on line 21, there is a section under provision under current law under 3B to get that taken away if you have made like the clerical error like was mentioned. Also under line 23 on page 1, the Department of Justice shall remove the offender from the register. It puts a burden on the Department of Justice to watch all of that, and it also opens up the state of Montana to lawsuits if that somehow there's a clerical error on the DOJ's part and that is missed. So with all due respect to the bill sponsor, we request to do not pass on House Bill 91. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Doan. Are there any other opponents? Opponents. Again, last call. If anybody would like to testify as an opponent remotely, please hit star 9 to put your hand up. I'm not seeing anyone. Unless Ms. Swain tells me differently, we'll move on. I see no other witnesses in the room. Are there any informational witnesses? Informational witnesses. Informational witnesses. Seeing none. Questions from the committee? Questions from the committee. Representative Kelker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Question for the sponsor.
Representative Ferris Olson.
Mr. Chair. Representative Ferris Olson.
Representative Kelker.
Pardon me?
Representative Kelker, can you bring the microphone a little bit closer?
I'm asked, okay. Representative Ferris Olson, could you explain the work that went into this bill from the Law and Justice Committee? There was quite a great deal of concern, as I recall, about the difficulty of getting your name off of the registry. Can you help us with that?
Yes, Mr. Chair, Representative Kelker. So I should say, first of all, this bill came out of a study bill for the Sexual and Violent Offender Registry List. I think it's maybe the only bill that the Law and Justice Interim Committee passed related to that study area. And we worked on it for, a year and a half, constantly discussing, even getting rid of the Violent Offender Registry. And ultimately, this is what we decided on because we certainly understood the risks that come with having a violent history and the need for community safety. And so we thought this was kind of the best, at least from what I'm remembering, and I'm sure Representative Kelker and Representative Usher can correct me if I'm wrong, but this was the best way to address those both sides of that issue, where we looked at community safety, but also made sure that people are able to get off of it. And I think kind of the best example of what can happen is this case that happened that came down in October. I think the gentleman registered for 10 years and then kept registering for a few more years. And then in 2014 or 12 or 14 years after he'd been convicted and multiple years after he'd reached that 10-year threshold, he was convicted of failing to register and sent to jail for 5 years. And I don't know if he got a fine or not. And that's all because he failed to file the petition that would have automatically removed him. And so people don't always know that they can just file this petition. It's kind of a pain in the butt. I've filed one in my career for a sexual offender, and that's more difficult, but people just don't know the process. And so getting off of this list can be difficult and time consuming. And again, this just balances the community safety versus the rehabilitation and getting those folks back into the community. So I hope that answers your question, Representative.
It does. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative.
Further questions from the committee? Further questions from the committee? Representative Gillette.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a question for Mr. Doan.
Mr. Doan.
Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Doan, considering things are so electronic now, is there not a way to automate that, or would it take a person on the other end to actually manage and monitor these cases?
Mr. Chairman, I believe there will be a fiscal note coming that could give you an accurate answer to that question. I don't want to speculate on that.
Follow up. Thank you, Mr. Chair. About how many cases do you think we're talking about in any given year?
Mr. Chairman, Representative, I just clicked on the website the other day just for Helena. I think there was 18 just in the Helena area. I'm not sure what that number would be statewide. I could get that for you.
Follow up. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess I'm wondering, when you get that data, if what I'm really looking for is in a year, how many people that where their 10 years is up? You know, how many people are we talking about in any given year that their 10 years is up? Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, I believe that number would obviously vary from year to year. I could probably find out what an average would be on that.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Doan. Any further questions from the committee? Representative Skies.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a question for the bill sponsor, if you would.
Representative Harris Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative. I see that you requested a fiscal note on the 29th. Could you update us on when you expect to receive the fiscal note, please?
Mr. Chair, Representative Skies, I was unaware that I had asked for one, but I don't know. That might be a better question for Mr. Doan. I would note, though, with the fiscal note, certainly there's going to be a larger initial expenditure because we've got to identify those people whose 10 years have elapsed and then were convicted, and then the DOJ has to notify the courts. So certainly there will be that time-consuming upfront cost. But if we look at the ongoing costs, DOJ already keeps all of this data. And secondly, they're already required to do this under that Sedler case that came out in October. They've got to get people off the register after the 10 years have elapsed. And so there really is no added cost besides that initial cost of finding those people whose convictions need to be vacated. But they've already got that data.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Tenenbaum.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I've got a question for the bill sponsor. When the Montana Supreme Court struck down the statute that this bill cleans up, it's my understanding that they identified the number of cases, or at least the briefing in the case, identified the number of people who actually, at the end of their 10-year period, had the wherewithal and awareness to actually file to remove themselves from the registry. Do you remember that exact number or approximate number?
Mr. Chair, Representative Tenenbaum, I do not. But if there are other questions, I'm happy to find it real quick and get back to you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you.
Thank you. Further questions from the committee? No further questions from the committee. Representative Ferris Olson, would you like to close on your bill?
I would, Mr. Chair. Thank you. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, as I mentioned when I opened this case, this bill really is a cleanup bill after the Supreme Court already ruled that after 10 years, a person needs to automatically be removed from the registry. So while I certainly respect the Attorney General and Mr. Doan's comments that this is problematic for them, they already have this responsibility. And so it just makes our law align with Supreme Court law that, again, found this law facially invalid because it was just unreasonable burden on those who are convicted. And it's, again, just a simple ministerial task. And I would also note that with the fiscal note, I'm certain there will be costs, but most of those costs will have to be borne anyways, again, because of Sedler. But secondly, I would say that, you know, the cost will ultimately go down when we're not having people have to petition the court. So I hope the fiscal notes takes into account the reduction of the caseload the courts have as a result of the decreased number of petitions they're getting in the future. And second and lastly, I would just say this is the right thing to do. These folks have served their time. They've spent 10 years registering and they've complied with their obligations. And so it's time to help them come back into our communities. And I think that's something that the Law and Justice Interim Committee recognized when we passed this out 11-0 in September or unanimously. So, again, I'd urge you to support House Bill 91. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Ferris Olson. This will close the hearing on House Bill 91. Stand at ease for a minute. Before we open the next hearing, I just also forgot to mention that the reason why I have two screens now is, one, this one actually has the same thing as what those do. The only difference is I can see people remotely when they put their hands up. And this one is only between myself and Ms. Weiss, who usually is sitting here, that I can ask procedural questions to, and also with our secretary and our Zoom manager. So it's just a procedural thing. If anybody wants to come up and double check that, I'm okay with that. I have no issues with that. Representative Mitchell, are you ready to open the hearing on House Bill 124? Representative Mitchell, would you like to open on your bill?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Representative Braxton Mitchell, M-I-T-C-H-E-L-L, from House District 3, notably the Gateway to Glacier National Park and the Flathead. Thank you for the opportunity to hear House Bill 124, titled Suffering Wildlife Protection Act. This bill is something many in my district and across the state of Montana have been calling for years. The reason I'm bringing this bill is due to the commonality in the state of Montana where game animals are often hit and left to suffer on the side of the road or in ditches, and currently in statutes, citizens have to wait until an officer can arrive at the scene in order to dispatch a suffering injured game animal. The legislative intent of my bill is to allow an individual to discharge a firearm within city limits to dispatch an injured game animal, most commonly deer, under certain conditions. Those conditions being, a person shall first notify the local police department, or if one does not exist, the county sheriff's office about an injured game animal. If a law enforcement officer does not respond in a reasonable amount of time, the person may dispatch the animal after notifying individuals within a reasonable distance of the site that a firearm is about to be discharged. I will mention, so questions aren't asked, that reasonable is a legal term, which would allow the courts to decide. After dispatching an injured game animal, the person shall remain at the site until a law enforcement officer arrives. Law enforcement officers shall determine whether the animal had injuries that justified the discharging of the firearm. If the law enforcement officer determines that discharge of the firearm was justified, the person may not be held criminally liable for doing so. The person is liable for any resulting property damage or injury to a third party. The meat of the game animals must be donated directly to a Montana food bank network or to a public charitable institution to the extent reasonably feasible.
Thank you. We're going to have proponents, opponents, and informational witnesses. Please, when you come up to the podium, please state and spell your name and who you represent. If you have any exhibits or written testimony, please give those to the secretary. Please do not read your testimony. Or if you're repeating what someone before you said, just say, I agree with everything they said. We're going to go with proponents first. If there's any proponents remotely, please hit *9, put your hand up. *9 to put your hand up. Do we have any proponents in person? Proponents. Seeing none, I see none online. We'll move to opponents. Are there any opponents online? Please hit *9, put your hand up. No opponents in person. Do we have any informational witnesses? Informational witnesses, see none online, none in person. Representative Mitchell, would you like to close on your, I'm sorry, questions from the committee? Questions from the committee. Don't see any online, don't see any in person. Representative Mitchell, would you like to close on your bill?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I would like to thank you for the opportunity to speak on behalf of my bill. I believe, along with my constituents and the people of Montana, this is very common sense legislation and great for rural communities, and I respectfully ask a due pass on House Bill 124.
Thank you. Very well done for your first one. This closes the hearing on House Bill 124. We have no further hearings today. We're going to go to caucus. Representative Kelker, do you all have any objection if we put 124 in exec today? We had no opponents, proponents, or questions. Without objection, we'll put that on exec action to get that out of our committee today. Let's go to caucus until 10:35. Judiciary Committee back to order. Sorry, it took us a few minutes early or longer than expected. It was our first caucus, and we were teaching a few new people how it goes. Let's open executive action on House Bill 28. Madam Vice Chair.
Mr. Chair, I move that House Bill 28 do pass.
Discussion, questions from the committee? Any questions from the committee? I don't see any hands up remote.
Question.
Question's been called. Let's try a voice vote. All in favor of do pass, say aye.
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 All opposed, say nay. Motion passes. We'll open executive action on House Bill 92. Madam Vice Chair.
Mr. Chair, I move that House Bill 92 do pass.
Open the discussion. Any questions from the committee? Representative Hinkle.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a few questions. Try to find where I'm at right here. So first off, I want to get some clarification on this offset provision. And on line 17, and it may say, this is on page 6, line 17, it says, less any amounts paid to the attorneys for actual costs and expenses in litigating the other civil action or obtaining the settlement agreement. So what I'm trying to get clarified here is, you know, it was identified in during the hearing that an individual who receives the damages of $60,000 or $25,000 per year, that they are still able to use that money to sue the state for more money. And from what I'm understanding is if they do that and they're awarded more money, then they need the offset privileges or offset provisions require them to pay back that sum of money from the initial damages to $60,000 to $25,000 per year. And I think this line here, I'm trying to find out if this line means they pay it all back or they pay it all back except what the attorney's fees are. Like, what? Who are the attorneys in this line? And then do they pay all the money back to the state, or do they pay it all back except for what they had spent on legal expenses?
Ms. Weiss, can you answer that?
Mr. Chair, committee members, I read it as they pay it all back except for the money paid to attorneys for those legal expenses. In this particular line, in subsection 1, these are only for awards made at the time that somebody is making a claim or would be making a claim using this bill. Subsection 2 controls for any damages awarded if after someone would use this bill. So there is kind of a time difference there. But Representative Hinkle, your second formulation was correct. You'd pay whatever amount you were awarded back except for the attorney's fees. Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
Further questions, Representative Ferris Olson?
Mr. Chair, can you pause for a second? I think the room got muted, so we're having trouble hearing you, and we need to have IT unmute the room. Just a second.
Why don't we just stand at ease?
so far.
Discipline?
Yeah.
I think it's awesome. I told my wife, I said, I'm going to start doing this in the committee. I got to represent, man.
I was back posture director because I just felt like I just slumped too much. And so I tried to finish it.
I went to a little Catholic private school, and the nuns would hit you with those 3 yards, yeah, the yardstick rulers, if you weren't, you know. They'd hit you if your tie was tied wrong. Of course, I'm old. That was a long time ago. They put your knuckles on the table like this and rack your knuckles. Ah, those are the good old days. Of course, now that'd be child abuse.
Mr. Chair, it looks like the room is unmuted again.
Thank you, Judiciary Committee. Come back to order. And I think I just asked Representative Ferris Olson what his question was.
Mr. Chair, thanks. I just needed to disclose I represent one of the wrongfully convicted people that potentially would be able to exercise his rights under this act. I just need to make that disclosure. If anyone has any questions, I'm happy to answer them. Thanks.
Thank you. Further questions from the committee? Representative Lear.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I move...
You need to get much closer to that microphone, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Still a little bit closer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I move to amend House Bill 92. The amendment is 92.1.1. After the time, and the amendment reads...
Do you have a copy of that?
Yes, I have the copy. I will...
Can you please pass that around?
I'm going to pass that down.
Mr. Chair, can we just assure this is also available for participants online?
Go ahead, Ms. Weiss.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Bishop, I did email out the people online, and actually also everyone in the room should have an electronic copy of these amendments. So if anyone didn't get that email, please let me know.
Does anybody online need a few minutes to find that on their computer? Or is everybody good? Okay, go ahead, Representative Lear.
Mr. Chair. I move to amend House Bill 92 with the amendment 92.1.1. The amendment reads that after the time of a damage awarded made pursuant to Section 5, the claimant may not pursue an action against the state in state or federal court relating to the same subject. By doing this, we will, in a sense, protect the taxpayer from the claimant using the funds that he receives as seed dollars to go out to pursue more legal action that will cost the taxpayers more. Thank you.
Mr. Chair?
Ms. Vice Chair?
I would ask Rachel to weigh in on the title. We were told when we were working on this bill that we have no ability to restrict people from going into federal court.
Ms. Weiss.
Mr. Chair, committee members, Representative Kelker, it was a little unclear, but I think, were you asking a title question or a legal question?
Title question. we really had this discussion while we were crafting the bill, and we were told that we cannot hold people back from using the federal court. So that's why it's not in the title.
Mr. Chairman, committee members, so the title that Representative Kelker is working off of are on lines 5 through 9, and the title would provide compensation for people who have been wrongly convicted of felony crimes and exonerated. So that's kind of, as I call it, like the umbrella under which all the other title provisions need to fit. I guess why this wasn't in the title prior is because the bill as drafted does not contain any limits on a claimant's ability to seek damages in a court for an action that was filed for similar or the same subject. So I don't necessarily see a title question here. What the committee might want to consider is there could be questions raised about whether the state can limit someone's ability to file an action in court and seek justice in court. But I guess this is a good time to remind the committee that we don't provide legal notes on amendments. And when legal questions come up, we certainly work with the amendment requester if we have concerns. But other than that, you know, there wouldn't be anything quite as formal as a legal note that you would see. And then, Mr. Chair, if I might just say to clarify, too, if anyone's wondering about the number 2 amendment, which you see on page 1, line 17, where after commit, semicolon, we're striking the and, that was a technical change. There is just a small thing that slipped through during drafting, and the editors asked that we change that. So the substance of the amendment is exactly as Representative Lear has described. Mr. Chair.
Before Representative Hinkle goes, I will say that we did meet with the ACLU for full disclosure, and they have raised the question of constitutionality if this goes on, and there is a severability clause. So if that is found, if this amendment is found to be unconstitutional, it does not kill the entire bill. Representative Hinkle.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just to clarify again, and maybe you can answer this, was it just there may be a constitutional issue if they filed in federal court versus state court? Was it specifically federal court?
I would say that they just said overall you cannot restrict access to justice. Again, that's where the courts would have to say, you know, the meaning of this state court versus federal court, because there's already laws on the books. Not quite sure that completely answered your question. I'm not an attorney.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative France, you're still on mute, Representative France.
Mr. Chair, I was just going to ask people to speak up a little more. Some of these statements I want to hear, and they're just coming across a little garbled and hard to follow.
Thank you. I will work on that. Representative Ferris Olson.
Mr. Chair, thanks. I just wanted to address Representative Hinkle's concerns. I think where you run into the constitutional issue is you would be preventing a person from pursuing their federal remedy under 42 USC 1983, which I think runs into problems with the supremacy clause. This has not been litigated. There's something similar being litigated in Washington, if I remember, but there's no final resolution yet. And secondly, I think the other issue we discussed during the Law and Justice Interim Committee was if we're now basically saying the state is not immune from suit, or I guess is immune from suit, we've got a constitutional provision that requires, I can't remember if it's I think it's a 2/3 vote to get that immunity through the House. And last, I would just note, I think the offset provision is effective the way it's written, because you wouldn't recover, like even if you spent, say you get $800,000, if you spend that $800,000 pursuing this other suit, that gets cut off the top. And so it's not like you'd have to pay back the money. You just wouldn't get the additional money. And there, frankly, there just aren't that many suits going on right now. I think Representative Kelker mentioned there were seven and only a few of them actually would qualify under this law. So I hope that's helpful.
It is. Thank you. Also, to clarify, since you jogged my memory, if I remember correctly, it's actually only four of them qualify if this passes. And then also, we did get the Innocent Project sent, myself and Representative Lear. We asked the question, how many people across the nation, because this is a nation, basically all states are trying to pass this right now, how many people actually take this money from the state and then turn around and sue in federal court? And the answer they got back within an hour was it's less than 10%, or 10% of the people take this and then continue to sue in federal court. So it's not a lot. So 10% of four qualified. I mean, it wouldn't be much in Montana. Representative Carlson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a comment that's kind of a question. Hopefully someone can help me. With the Section 2 there, if we completely strike that, what does that do to someone who is currently, if there is, someone currently in the midst of a 10-year process of, before this law passing, of getting their satisfaction? And if we strike that, then are we saying that they must abandon their case? I'm sorry, I just don't understand that. If someone could, page 6, the section 2 that's being proposed to strike in the amendment, line 21. It kind of stems from the...
So let me clarify that. So that's actually new section 6, subsection 2A, line 21. When you said section 2, everybody was looking on page 1 because it says section 2 on page 1. So did everybody understand where that is? Page 6, section new section 6, line 21, which is subsection 2A. Did everybody find that? Also, for the freshmen, I forgot to mention this for the freshmen's sake, is it does not always have to be a question when we're in executive. It can be a comment. It can be a statement. If you're adamantly opposed or for this and you can say why, it does not have to be a question, because obviously we're not taking any testimony. We can't ask proponents or opponents questions. So to answer your question is, I don't know the answer to that. I don't know if Ms. Weiss would like to weigh in on that.
Mr. Chairman, committee members, so you are striking, or this amendment would strike lines 21 all the way through page 1 on line 7. Subsection 2 applies to a person who uses the process set out in this bill to make a claim and wins a monetary award, and then files a lawsuit. So this wouldn't affect somebody whose lawsuit is currently in place, simply because this particular subsection is only looking forward prospectively, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Further questions or comments? Representative Fleming.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just had a comment. I also was on that interim committee that this bill came from, and my recollection was similar to Representative Kelker. We looked at this extensively, and the information, I guess, that we got, that we could not prevent them from going into federal court with this, that was a constitutional issue, and the best advice we got at the time, as I recall, was to pass it as is. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Burgley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess first I probably have a question for the sponsor. So one of the questions that came up is that the the amount that's paid back to the state if a second settlement is awarded is less attorney fees and cost expenses with the civil litigation for the first one. I was just curious if anybody knew how much that number usually was. I mean, we've heard stories about this taking 10 years. 10 years of litigation can add up to, I would assume, quite a good number. So that was my first question. Then I have a follow-up. I don't know if the sponsor of the bill would be the best person for that, or...
I was going to say, let's save the sponsor of the bill and ask Representative Ferris Olson.
Mr. Chair, Representative Burgley. So if I understand it, your question was how much would an attorney get if they pursued just a normal case? Is that accurate?
Mr. Chair, just to clarify, yeah, just the amount that would be not paid back to the state. So how big of that chunk is of the initial litigation that wouldn't be paid back if they were awarded a secondary?
Okay, so Mr. Chair, Representative Burgley, if they pursued this new cause of action, I think the bill provides for $25,000 for fees and then actual costs. For actual costs, you're looking, depending on the complexity of the case, whether it's you need an, depending on the experts you need to pay, which are a third party, then those costs can be $25,000 to $50,000 in experts. But the attorney's fees under this bill are $25,000. So unless the court finds a different reasonable amount would be appropriate. So you're looking at the attorney keeping $25,000 or whatever, and the experts keeping the money that they were paid, which could be minimal or could be, I would guess, around 50. I mean, in the cases we've seen, I think costs for experts are around 25. So roughly 50,000 would not be paid back. But I also just don't see that. I'm sorry, there just aren't that many of these cases. Does that answer your question, Representative Burgley?
It does. Thank you, Representative, Mr. Chair.
Representative Tenenbaum.
Mr. Chair, I just had a question, and it might be best answered by Ms. Weiss, but if we...
You must have accidentally muted. There you go.
Sorry, I just accidentally muted myself. The amendment that Representative Lehr just introduced, if we wanted to just stick with the change that is made on line 19 on page 1, that I think... Ms. Weiss referred to as like a typographical error, just a minor change. Would that have to come as a conceptual amendment after resolving this current amendment? Thank you.
Mr. Chair, committee members, I would say if this amendment doesn't go on the bill, I wouldn't worry about the technical error. We can change that in codification. If there's another amendment, we can fix that then. It's just as an amendment is drafted, if something small like that comes up, we do try and fix it, but I wouldn't. It's not big enough to worry about in going through conceptuals and isolating amendments and all that. So,
thank you.
Thank you. Further questions or comments? Discussion? Question's been called. I think we need to do a roll call vote on the amendment HB92.1.1.
Vice Chair Regeer?
Yes.
Vice Chair Kelker?
No.
Representative Carlson?
No.
Representative Stromswold?
Yes.
Representative Burgley?
Yes.
Representative Phelan?
Yes.
Representative Fleming?
No.
Representative Staffman?
No.
Representative Lenz?
Aye.
Representative Gillette?
Yes.
Representative Lehr?
Yes.
Representative Tenenbaum?
No.
Representative Bishop?
No.
Representative Hinkle?
Yes.
Representative Hawk?
No.
Representative Skies?
Aye.
Representative Ferris Olson?
No.
Representative France?
You're muted, but I think I saw the lip said no.
Chair Esser.
That's correct, Mr. Chair. No vote.
Yes.
Motion passes 10 to 9.
Motion passes.
Mr. Chair, I move that House Bill 92 do pass as amended.
Discussion on the bill as amended. Representative Hinkle.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd like to move a conceptual amendment. And that conceptual amendment would be to strike federal court in the amendment that we just put on the bill.
Can you specify page, line number?
This would be in the, thank you, Mr. Chair, this would be in the title, line 9, and where it's, we're inserting limiting a claimant who receives compensation from filing an action in state or federal court. And actually, I'd like to amend my conceptual amendment to say or federal court will be struck from that. And then again, in page 6, line 21 through page 7, where we inserted the language, after the time pursuant of damages award make pursuant to section 5, the claimant may not pursue an action against the state in state and again will strike or federal court. Mr. Chair. Or federal. So to clarify, what I'm striking is the word or federal.
Let me go back again. Please state the page and the line number for each of your strike or adds so we can make sure that everyone in the room is clear and Ms. Weiss is clear.
Okay, Mr. Chair. First one is in the title, and it's line 9. And we're going to strike.
No, there. Go ahead.
Amendment, it's changed. With the amendment we just passed, it now says that.
Yeah.
So okay. Or federal right.
In the title, line 9. Okay. So you're with the amendment.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, we have to look on the amendment right. Language.
Does everybody understand that?
Yes.
Okay. Go ahead.
Okay, so then in line 9, on the amendment that we just placed on the bill, we are striking the words or federal. Okay. And then additionally,
okay.
On page 6, I guess it's line 21 through page 7, line 1, on the amendments, we're also going to strike the language or federal. And that's in subsection 2 there.
Ms. Weiss, did you understand that?
Mr. Chairman, committee members, I did. And if you might, I would be happy to read the new subsection as it would read if you put Representative Hinkle's amendment on the amendment. Would that help?
Does anybody need that done or no? Everybody understands it?
Okay.
Kind of a little out of order, but since we have a representative from an organization, does that help clear up for you all or no? Okay.
Do you want me to?
If you can take 1 or 2 seconds, yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Dean S.K. Rossi, Innocence Project. I guess it clears up the issue with preempting a federal cause of action. I have to read it, honestly.
Okay, that's fine.
I don't think it does where pose the amendment going on in the first place. I have to go back through the bill and read what the amendments are going to do to it.
That's fine. Thank you. Again, that was very unusual to do that, but
so there won't be feedback.
Any questions, discussion on Representative Hinkle's conceptual amendment? Question's been called. We'll do a roll call vote.
Vice Chair Regeer?
Yes.
Vice Chair Kelker?
Yes.
Representative Carlson?
Yes.
Representative Stromswald?
Yes.
Representative Burgley?
Aye.
Representative Phelan?
Yes.
Representative Fleming?
Yes.
Representative Staffman?
Yes.
Representative Lenz?
Aye.
Representative Gillette?
Yes.
Representative Lear?
Yes.
Representative Tenenbaum?
Yes.
Representative Bishop?
Yes.
Representative Hinkle?
Yes.
Representative Hawk?
Yes.
Representative Skies?
Nay.
Representative Ferris Olson?
Yes.
Representative France?
Yes.
Chair Usher?
Nay.
Motion passes 17 to 2.
Motion passes. Representative Vice Chair Regeer.
Mr. Chair, I move that House Bill 92 do pass as amended.
In the future, actually, you say twice, as twice amended. Any discussion now that the bill has been amended twice? Discussions or comments? Representative Hinkle.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And maybe the sponsor could answer this. If not, maybe somebody else. But
the sponsor of the amendment or sponsor of the bill?
Sponsor of the bill. Thank you. All right. Mr. Chair, under the normal lawsuits, where or what budget do the damages awarded generally come from? Like we talk about these lawsuits that take years and years and years. Where is that those monies generally paid out of?
Vice Chair Kalker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative, this is a policy bill, and it doesn't have a specific line item to say where those would come from. Under normal circumstances, it would come from the tort liability section in state administration, where they have insurance policies for liabilities of all kinds of the state. That question needs to be decided by the appropriations folks, not us here.
Thank you, Representative.
Further questions, discussion? Representative Skies.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. The reason I voted against that amendment is I've been struggling against the Supremacy Clause and its correct interpretation. I think if we give state money to a person, they shouldn't be able to use it to go against the feds as well as the state, which is why I voted against it. But I love this bill and I love both the amendments, so I will be a yes. Thank you, sir.
Before the question, I wanted to say why I voted against it. I voted against it because I don't like to be blindsided. And typically when there's amendments, our members come and at least talk to the chair. Question's been called. Let's do a voice vote. All in favor of House Bill... New pass on House Bill 92, say aye.
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 Aye. Aye.
All against, say nay. Motion passes. House Bill 92 is passed. Representative Lentz.
Mr. Chairman, just a question about the conceptual amendment thing that was discussed in our first hearing, that wouldn't be occurring. Is that it was my understanding. Is that correct or not, Mr. Chair, on conceptual amendments?
I'm not sure what your question is.
Mr. Chair, the what Representative Hinkle brought forward that wasn't in a written form and provided some confusion as to what we were voting on. Took a little bit to get through that. Is that going to be a common practice, or will be? I guess I'm asking for the members of the committee. I would appreciate if it was more clear in the future, Mr. Chair.
So I am typically not going to allow conceptual amendments, only because I found out. One, I was in shock for a couple minutes there, and then I realized it was only one word. I allowed it this time, and I was going to bring that up at the end of executive, that you know, as I said earlier, we need to give our staff 24 hours, and it's not fair to our staff to, one, do a conceptual, do any amendment after the 24 hours. And a conceptual is, one, confusing to everybody on the committee and our staff. And to actually get it right, hopefully it was clear enough, and that's why I was trying to be very specific, to make sure that the record will show exactly what Ms. Weiss will end up having to write out. So that's my, unless anybody has an objection to that, I just think conceptual is not fair to the committee or to our staff. Representative Hinkle.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just from my previous experience, of course, it was in another chamber, another committee, but generally if we did a conceptual amendment, it was an amendment with one or two words that was not very confusing. So we generally wouldn't do a conceptual amendment with a whole sentence or line or something like that. So I apologize, but that was just my previous experience. Thank you.
So what I also said is I was caught off guard. If I would have known in advance that we were doing a conceptual and it was one or two words, I would have gotten together with both vice chairs to make sure that everybody was clear in advance. And I would probably have given our staff a heads up so she could be ready to do it. That if everybody's okay with that. Representative Lentz.
Mr. Chair, I would also like to remind the committee that a cleaner option on this would have been to segregate out those words when the amendment was brought forward. That would have been a cleaner option on this, Mr. Chair.
Representative Burgley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think Representative Skies might be adding to this conversation, whereas I'm starting a different one.
You in the same discussion?
Yes, Mr. Chair, I wanted to speak to what Representative Lentz was saying because the Representative Hinkle came to me beforehand. And actually, this is in H3050-11. When an action is formally taken by a committee, you cannot alter in the committee except by reconsideration or further former action. So if we were to try and segregate the amendment that was moved, you would have to segregate the component of the amendment. You couldn't segregate a component of the component. So it's unfortunate there's only certain ways we could do that. You're right, Representative Lentz, we could have segregated a section out of it, but just the one word, I think the way we did it was really the only way that we could have done it. And I would also say, since you've called on me, for the record, most of the things they do in the Senate is wrong.
Thank you for clarifying that, Representative Burgley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just to deal with conceptual amendments, because I may have one on this next amendment, under this next bill, but I think traditionally in the four sessions that I've been in judiciary, I think the idea behind conceptual amendments and giving the staff as much of a heads up as possible is obviously great, but I would say that I think it is also cleaner to, if it is a simple, straightforward, understandable type amendment. We have a lot of complex bills in judiciary. I think if it's something that the committee understands, and I know we have a lot of freshmen, so that makes it more difficult, but I think if it's a clear amendment that everybody understands, I think it would be to the benefit of the body to amend it in committee so that we're not then going to the floor and confusing people on a bill on the floor. I think it's easier to work through it in a small group when we have more time than it is to send any bill to the floor and then try and make an amendment, especially early on in the session. We have a lot of bills with moving parts that we're trying to get through on timelines. So I would say as the session goes on, we have more time. But I think now everyone's trying to do the best they can. And I think doing it in committee is a cleaner way of doing it potentially, unless it's a very controversial type amendment, Mr. Chair.
Good comments. I think that there's a couple other solutions to that. One is we could table it for amendments to be done, so we give our staff the last thing I want is our staff running crazy because they're already running around trying to make everybody happy. So if there's I would prefer it that way, and that way it comes out of our place, our committee, cleaner than us just willy-nilly doing it. So I agree with what you said. We have complex bills. I would rather get it done here than up on the floor. But again, I'm just trying to make sure that our staff has the time and that every single committee member understands completely what we're actually passing or not passing. So, but I have agreed with all the comments, good comments. And I saw somebody else's hand. Representative Carlson, I find it amazing that we're taking so much time on this one when the supposed controversial bill hasn't even hit the committee yet.
You copied what I was about to say, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Anything else? We will get, as a team, I'm sorry. Did somebody say something online? No. We will get a little bit smoother as a group, and you know, we'll learn as we go and try and work together the best we can. So that closes the hearing. Did I already close the hearing? Okay, so we have to open the hearing on HB 102. Vice Chair Regeer.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 102 do pass.
Representative Burgley.
Thank you, Chair. Mr. Chair, I would like to move that House Bill 102 be amended with Amendment HB 102.1.2.
Do you have copies of that, Representative Burgley? Because I did not get one.
Mr. Chair, I believe they were passed out prior to us going to
caucus.
That's
okay. I'm good. Did you want to discuss that?
Mr. Chair, I would love to. Members of the committee, Mr. Chair, just to walk through this briefly. So I think if you have the bill in front of you, I can just go through and kind of line by line point out what the amendment does. It's not nearly as complicated as it seems, so bear with me. So the first one is on page 2, line 1. In the legislative findings section, there's a section that states the schools and the Montana University system. So to alleviate any confusion with this bill dealing with K-12 education, I am striking schools and the from that first line, so it will read the Montana University system, and then I'm striking where or were and putting in was to make it singular, which would be that's the second amendment, and then three changes on the third line down, private property, are to is. So that's just to clean up that section. The next change will be on lower down on page 2, which is in section 4, line 20. And what that does is it adds to in a correctional detention or treatment facility operated by or contracted with the Department of Corrections. And it adds to that or a secure treatment facility operated by the Department of Health and Human Services. The next will be on line 26, which is subsection 6, which is on private property. It just clarifies that the owner, it's not just the owner of the property. It adds, or the person who possesses or is in control of the property, including a tenant or lessee of the property. That just cleans up some concerns that people had with somebody possibly not owning the business and not being able to determine whether or not firearms could be brought on the property, since this bill specifically stated owned. In traditional interpretations of law, generally ownership, the rights of ownership are transferred to a lessee, but I just wanted that to be clear. The next amendment would be adding a sub 7 to that, which would state within a courtroom pursuant to an order of the justice of the peace or judge. So this would just give a judge or justice of the peace the ability to regulate a courtroom they were presiding in for the purposes of disallowing firearms. The next will be on page 3, line 10, which is stating this has to do with the Board of Regents, the university system, and allowing firearms. So it says that any person, they may not regulate, restrict, or place an undue burden on possession, transportation, or storage of firearms on or within university system by a person eligible to possess a firearm under state or federal law. and it just adds, and meeting the minimum safety and training requirements in 45.8.321 sub 3. I did pass out that section. That section is the familiarity requirements to obtain a concealed carry permit. So in order to have a firearm on university property or Board of Regents property, depending on how you look at that, it would require that you have the same amount of training as required for a concealed carry permit. The next will be page 4. So this one is a little bit... So line 1 following through 7. Just striking that. Let's see. Basically, it just changes the language on that's denied, diminished, or intentionally delayed. It changes intentionally to wrongfully, which is a legal term. To clean that up a little bit, I didn't want there to be a misunderstanding about intentionally delayed, what that meant. Some people had some questions about that, so changing it to wrongfully, I feel like, is cleaner language. The next one basically just cleans up sort of the reiteration of language. So the way that it reads now is that are denied, diminished, or wrongfully delayed has a cause of action against. This strikes any private entity or employee of any private entity on line 2. So the reason that was taken out was it created some confusion on how this would apply to somebody who owned private property or a business, if you're allowing them to prohibit, and then there's a cause of action that would then have a private entity. There were some specific cases where I think this could be used, but just to clear up that confusion, that section, any private entity or employee of any private entity, was struck. So the other, on line 4, the language was struck. So after delayed, the phrase or the line has a cause of action against any private or private entity or employee of an entity was struck. Then the next word by was inserted. So the way that this would read in whole, if you read to that line, up to that point, is any person whose constitutional rights protected under sections 1 through 7 are denied, diminished, or wrongfully delayed by the state of Montana or a subdivision of the state, including local government or employee of the state of Montana or subdivision of the state and local government. And then following government, it strikes who denied, diminished, or intentionally delayed those rights, or who was responsible for the denial, diminishment, or intentional delay. That section is struck. So who on line 7 through delay on line 8, and then it was added has a cause of action. So rather than stating the cause of action, intentionally delayed, denied section twice, I just changed that to say by the state of Montana has a cause of action, just to clean that up so it's not restating that section twice. And then the final on the bottom was a cause of action must be filed in district court. And then if a person asserting denial, diminishment, or intentionally is struck and wrongfully is added in front of delay. So it would read delay, denial, diminishment, or wrongful delay of rights. And that should be the last one.
You good? Representative Kelker?
Mr. Chair, I have a question about...
Can you speak up a little bit louder? It's also just a reminder, it's not just what we can hear here. Zoom has a harder time with the volume than we do here in the room. So thank you.
And I have perpetually a soft voice. I just have a question for you, Mr. Chair. When we met last on this bill, there was to be an amendment that came from the cities and towns or something like that. That never materialized?
Representative Coker, I'm not aware of it. They did not come to me. Did they come to you, Representative Burgley?
Mr. Chair, Representative Kelker, they did. The change dealing with courtrooms was one of the proposed amendments that they had. That was their main concern. They also had some concerns dealing with potential mental health. So they didn't talk about the facilities that added. That came more from a variety of people, but Disability Rights was one of the people that reached out, Ms. Brenneman. The main thing they had was the courtrooms and the ability of the judicial to regulate a courtroom, which was added in this amendment. Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Bishop.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Question for the sponsor.
Representative Berglund.
Sure. Great, thank you, Mr. Representative. Representative, Mr. Chair, I see that you're striking schools, but striking from the part that really just sort of sets up the intention, and wondering if you have any additional amendments planned or would be open to any that would specifically address the overall structure of the bill and code to exempt K-12 schools.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I do potentially, I don't have it drafted, so that would go to the conceptual aspect. However, I will say that in 45.8.361 is the section of code. Most of this is based in 45.3. That would be the last section which deals with the school board's ability to regulate firearms in a school building. I haven't touched any of that code. There has been some talk of a potential conflict since this does have a specific list of exemptions. So I would not be opposed to adding language to the end of Section 4, which is the exemptions, to read except authority exercised by a school board under 45.8.361. But that would have to go to an additional amendment, I believe.
Thank you, Representative. Mr. Chair, follow-up then?
Follow-up. Let me ask Ms. Weiss. Ms. Weiss, I'm sure you just heard what Representative Burgley said, and I'm wondering if that actually would be a clarification of what is already in his amendment, since he said schools, and all his amendment, future amendment might say is, you know, it states the code, which defines what K through 12 is. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, committee members, I think Representative Burgley kind of accurately stated the potential concern that, you know, the places where you're taking schools out are kind of intent sections, but there is a pretty specific list of exemptions in Section 4. So if the committee wanted to make it absolutely clear that it intended to exempt public schools from areas where firearms could be carried, that would be one way to address that concern. So, you know, I'm not sure I have a whole lot to add there. And certainly, however the committee wants to go on a conceptual amendment, I've spoken with Representative Burgley and I understand what he's after. So if you do later on to decide to make a conceptual amendment, I would just ask that you, in that amendment, grant me the ability to work with Representative Burgley if any questions come up while we add that conceptual amendment, Mr. Chair.
Representative Bishop.
Great. Thank you, Mr. Chair. That was you. I very much appreciate your follow-up. I was basically going to inquire as to both the bill sponsor and your openness to a potential conceptual amendment. So thank you.
Does anybody have any objection if Representative Burgley goes down that road on this with that simpleness? I just saw somebody's hand raised and now it's gone. Okay. Waving off. Representative Hinkle.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the sponsor, let me see if I'm reading this correctly. On page 4, line 1, with the amendments, we are reading protected under sections 1 through 7 are denied, diminished, or wrongfully delayed by, and in the word or employee. Is that just a clerical error, or am I missing something here?
Mr. Chair, with the amendment that strikes the private entity or employee of any private entity, the way that those lines would read would be any person whose constitutional rights protected under sections 1 through 7, that would be struck, and it says are denied, diminished, or wrongfully delayed. And then from delayed through that next comma, has a cause of action against private entity or employee of any private entity, that's then struck. So it would read wrongfully delayed by the state of Montana or a subdivision of the state. So okay. The line 5, the first part of line, well, the end of line 4 after delayed where it says has a would be struck. And then line 5, cause of action through entity would be struck.
Mr. Chair, follow up. Thank you, Mr. Chair, Representative. Yeah, okay, I see that. Because I had originally just struck through the first entity, not the second entity. So if we're striking through the second entity, then it would go on, comma, the state. So I see that. Thank you.
Representative Carlson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is for a sponsor. And I really like your amendment as to the university's with the addition of the requirements for concealed carry. But I'm curious, is there a specific reason that you only used section or subsection, I'm sorry, I don't know the difference, 3, and did not include 2? Which is how you can not qualify for a concealed carry permit.
Mr. Chair, the reason that I use section, Representative Carlson, the reason that I use section 3, it was that it was specifically the way that it states in the law is that they're eligible to receive under state or federal law currently. The way that and I'd have to go look at that specifically in section 2, the breakdown of diseligibility for receiving the permit would apply under the local eligible under state or local or state or federal law would cover section 2, and then this would just be a training requirement or a safety requirement.
Follow up, Mr. Chair.
Follow up.
So just so you completely understand my question, if we're using this amendment to give some semblance of security, for lack of a better term there, peace of mind possibly, that there is a requirement implied there in order to conceal carry on campus, would it also make sense to include they must also be eligible under section 2 there on the requirements, which section 2 is actually the only way that you can be denied a concealed carry permit is if you do not meet the qualifications of being in good standing, basically. I hope my question is understood, Representative.
Mr. Chair and Representative, the idea behind the amendment change was to allow for a certain degree or requirement of safety or familiarity training. Section 2 specifically deals with the sheriff's ability to grant a permit to carry. The way that I approached this bill was not from the carry standard of getting a permit, since under this bill, Montana, you already have the ability to open carry in any of these places. So to require you to go through the sheriff to get a permit wasn't my intent. The way that it was originally written was the idea that under the Constitution, you have the right to own and carry a firearm. That's been laid out earlier in this bill. It points out the Chicago decision, and also under the D.C. Heller decision, that you have a right to carry a firearm to defend yourself. That's the premise that I'm working off of, is that if you are a of legal age, if you have are a upstanding citizen, that you meet all of the requirements, that the idea is that you have the right to carry on campus. This was simply adding a requirement for training, since that was a concern that some people had. I didn't want to get into the concealed carry granting requirements that a sheriff would then be involved in, whereas the sheriff is an elected official. If you put those requirements in here, it would make it more ambiguous to who would be making that decision, if it would be a university official, which are not elected, or any other official. So I didn't want to get into kind of that complication level. Mr. Chair, Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Tenenbaum.
Mr. Chair, I have a question for the sponsor. I'm totally behind the conceptual amendment to add schools to Section 4. I was just wondering if the conceptual amendment would also add schools to Section 10.
Representative Burgley.
Mr. Chair, I don't know that Section 10 would apply, in that this is only the deals with the carrying of a concealed permit in a prohibited place. The way that this language has changed in Section 10 is it allows somebody with a permit to carry in all of these places. So adding schools to the area allowed to carry with a permit, it would be going in the reverse of what the initial amendment was, to give school board officials the ability to regulate carry. Section 10 allows for concealed carry in all of the places listed. It's not a prohibition. It's a positive statement in terms of what areas you are allowed to carry in. It's not a statement of areas that you're disallowed to carry in, Mr. Chair.
Representative Tenenbaum, did he answer your question?
I think so. I'm going to take a closer look. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Kelker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Question for sponsor, please.
Representative Burgley.
Mr. Chair, Representative Burgley.
Representative Kelker.
Okay. We were just looking on page 4 where there were important changes in wording. And I just want to see if I have this clear, that were this bill to pass, towns, cities would not be able to have any kind of ordinance or rule or something that about parks or public demonstrations or we have a jazz fest on in Billings, that in any of those kind of public things where there's a large crowd, now cities and towns have lots of guidelines. So are you saying that concealed carry would be allowed in those sort of settings, and that cities and towns have no ability to regulate that?
Mr. Chair, Representative Kelker, so that's a bit of a nuanced question. The House Bill 357, which was also the LR 130, which passed last session, expressly denies local and state or anything below municipal and local governments from permitting or from regulating the carrying of permitted concealed carry weapons. So under the language of that was passed in the referendum, it prohibits cities, towns, consolidated local governments, or any local government that has power to prevent or suppress. It specifically only states that they have the ability to affect unpermitted concealed carry, and it says that for permitted concealed carry, they do not have the right to affect. And the language is publicly owned and anywhere that's not a publicly owned or occupied building. So it's already current law that you're allowed, that city, municipal, or county governments cannot regulate the carrying of permitted firearms in open areas. That's current law.
Follow up.
if you speak up.
I will. Mr. Chair and Representative, so your bill is talking about not permitted, not going to the sheriff, opportunities for concealed weapons.
Mr. Chair, Representative, so it does a couple different things. Basically, depending on the section that you're looking at, Section 4 deals with which is the areas that you cannot carry. So the Section 4 is you're not allowed to carry permitted, unpermitted, any type of carry, period. So that is a complete prohibition against concealed or non-concealed carry in those locations. The rest of the bill, in terms of Section 10, as was mentioned, Section 10 presents a list of areas that you have to have a permit to carry. So the bill kind of deals with two things. Open carry is already established law in most of these places, so you can already open carry. For instance, you can open carry in a bank, you can open carry in a bar, you can open carry in a restaurant that serves alcohol. So this bill doesn't address that. The permitless carry, the section that the bill deals with, would allow for somebody to carry a concealed weapon where you already have the ability to carry open carry, with a list of exceptions in Section 10. So Section 10 is the list of areas where you're not allowed to carry concealed without a permit, but you can carry concealed with a permit. So Section 4 is a complete prohibition. Section 10 is a separate prohibition against unpermitted carry, if that makes sense. So Section 4 is areas you can't carry, period. Section 10 is the areas you can only carry with a permit.
Thank you. That was helpful, Representative. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative France.
I believe you're still muted, Representative France.
There you go.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. A question for the sponsor.
Representative Burgley.
Mr. Chair.
Yeah, in regards to the university system, you and I had a conversation last week. I just wanted to be clear that in order to ensure that locks are placed on firearms that are outside the direct control, or in terms of assuring that students wishing to do concealed carry, that they actually have a safety, that they've complied with the requirements of the concealed carry. Does that imply that the universities would be able to, under your bill as you see it being implemented, that they'd be able to require some sort of registration or notification from students wishing to bring guns on campus so that they know these requirements are being complied with?
Mr. Chair, Representative France, I specifically didn't get into the minutia of how the university system would regulate this, so I don't have any prohibition against the university system, their internal workings, laws, regulations. I assume it would be something similar to the idea of a vehicle, if you have a vehicle on campus, or filling out waivers, you know, that every student signs an agreement with the university to go into a room or to live in a dorm room. I would assume that the university system would put whatever guidelines are required by this bill, allowing somebody to carry a firearm, that they would require that the students signed something to the effect that they would abide by whatever rules the university system put out, that would be a mutual agreement. I left that kind of specifically out to allow them some flexibility in determining how that would work.
Thank you, Representative Bergman.
Thank you. Any further questions or discussion? Representative Burgley, were you going to do that?
Mr. Chair, I believe that since we already have a do pass and an amendment, that we have that we can't add another conceptual amendment to this amendment since we're already on a second. So I believe we have to dispose of this motion before we can move to the next one.
Question.
I stand corrected, and the question has been called. Let's take a, and we're voting on the amendment. We'll do a roll call vote.
Vice Chair Regeer?
Yes.
Vice Chair Kelker?
Yes.
Representative Carlson?
Yes.
Representative Stromswald?
Yes.
Representative Burgley?
Aye.
Representative Phelan?
Yes.
Representative Fleming?
Yes.
Representative Staffman?
Yes.
Representative Lenz?
Aye.
Representative Gillette?
Yes.
Representative Lear?
Yes.
Representative Tenenbaum?
Yes.
Representative Bishop?
Yes.
Representative Hinkle?
Yes.
Representative Hawk?
Yes.
Representative Skies?
Aye.
Representative Ferris Olson?
Yes.
Representative France?
Yes.
Chair Usher?
Yes.
Motion passes 19 to 0.
So for those of you that don't know, Representative Skies is laughing because I should have known that that was going to be unanimous. Representative Burgley.
Thank you for your indulgence, Mr. Chair. With your permission, I would like to move a conceptual amendment to Section 4, which would state it would be adding...
You have to move the bill. Now that it's been amended, you have to move it.
Mr. Chair.
Vice Chair Regeer.
Mr. Chair, I move that House Bill 102 do pass as amended.
Representative Burgley.
My apologies, Mr. Chair. I should have caught that. I would like to move conceptual amendment B, page 2, section 4, new sub 8, since we added 7 as the courts, and it would read, accept authority exercised by a school board under 458361. And the section 458361 is the area that specifically states, let me pull this up real quick. It's the last subsection, and it's possession or allowing possession of weapons in school buildings, exceptions, penalty, seizure, and or forfeiture. So it allows school boards to regulate in schools.
For K through 12.
K through 12, correct.
Ms. Weiss, he was clear enough, like you said earlier. Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, yes, I got it.
Thank you. Any discussions, questions on that conceptual amendment? Representative Lenz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. A question for the sponsor.
Mr. Chair, Representative.
Representative Burgley, a little clarification. So on your amendment, we took out schools, just targeting the Montana University system. So if we're putting this conceptual amendment on, then that's isn't that a little bit, because we already took out the schools and now we're wanting to put them back in, so to speak. If you could clarify that, I'd appreciate it.
Mr. Chair, Representative Lenz. Yeah, so the area that dealt with the schools was in the legislative findings section, which was kind of a set of declarative facts of what we believe to be the case. Since it did state that schools and the university system were both public entities, which schools are public entities, but in the interest of segregating this out, it wasn't meant to necessarily apply to schools. That was sort of a broad statement of education. It wasn't my intent to target K through 12 education in this bill, so I removed that for clarification. But that didn't have any force of law in terms of regulating or not regulating carry in schools. This, as Ms. Weiss, I believe, alluded to, the way the section reads now is this is a prohibition against a person with a current or valid permit may not be prohibited or restricting from exercising that permit anywhere in the state except. And so there was some concern that since even though the school section was a separate area of code, this is a specific list of exceptions, schools weren't included in it. So there could be some ambiguity of whether or not this school section would take precedent over this section. Okay. Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Burgley. Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Seeing no, I'm sorry, Representative Staffman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. A question for Representative Burgley.
Mr. Chair, Representative Staffman.
Thank you, Representative. I'm curious as to how this bill on the amendment would impact private and religious schools. Could they limit concealed carry on their campuses or under the conceptual amendment or under the bill?
Thank you.
Pleasure. Mr. Chair and Representative Staffman, private religious schools would be private organizations, and so under sub 6, 2 up from this one, section 4, sub 6, it already gives public or private entities the ability to regulate or not regulate the carrying of firearms. So they would already have that right under sub 6.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr.
Representative Tenenbaum.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a question just for the sponsor. With this conceptual amendment, have we heard at all from the Association of School Boards or from OPI? Have they weighed in on this conceptual amendment?
Mr. Chair, Representative, I have not heard anything from the education community, the K-12 education community.
Thank you.
Question? Question's been called. Let's do a roll call vote on this conceptual amendment. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye.
All opposed, say aye. No. Motion or amendment passes. Unanimous. Vice Chair Regeer.
Mr. Chair, I move that House Bill 102 do pass as twice amended.
Representative Kelker.
We have an amendment to the bill. It is HB 102.1.4. And this bill is crafted by Representative Ed Staffman, and he can explain it. I'll pass out.
Representative Staffman, as it's getting passed out, if you want to start to explain it.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. This amendment would remove the parts of this bill which would prohibit the Board of Regents from controlling guns on Montana's university campuses. The amendment is critical for my constituents because my district borders and surrounds Montana State University. In fact, I can literally see Montana State University. It's just a half a block away from my front porch. College students are often away from home for the first time. Their parents see them as young people barely leaving childhood and expect their children to be protected on campus. This bill would steer good students away from Montana universities to places where their parents will expect that they can be safe. At the hearing, we did not hear of a single instance in 125 years of Montana University history where a student didn't have a gun he needed for self-defense. But we did hear in the written testimonies about a fatal shooting of two students at Langford Hall, 5 blocks from my home, by a fellow student, a shooting that deeply shook my constituents. This bill expressly acknowledges in multiple places that alcohol and drugs don't mix. But the reality is that alcohol use by college students is widespread both on and off campus. In my district, during campaign season, we place our yard signs at least 6 feet from the sidewalk, where they're likely to be kicked by a passing drunk college student. University attorney Helen Thigpen informed us that students over 21 may legally possess and consume alcohol on campus, and my constituents can attest to the many nearby drinking opportunities after which students head back to campus. As dangerous as the mixing of alcohol and guns creates for all university students, faculty, and staff, perhaps the larger danger is the suicides it will almost surely enable. We received written testimony from Dr. Lauren Wilson, Vice President of the Montana Association of the American Academy of Pediatrics. She noted extensive research on firearms death, which predict that this bill will dramatically increase the number of students taking their lives. She told us that mental health issues among students are common, with rates of depression in college students greater than 10%. In one study, she pointed to nearly 10% of undergraduates reported, quote, seriously considering suicide in the previous 12 months. This testimony should be considered alongside that of University Attorney Thigpen, who noted that among youth, 72% of suicides are committed with a gun. And for those of us who also serve on Health and Human Services Committee, we heard a suicide prevention bill this week presented through tears by a member of this body who lost his 18-year-old son to suicide. We learned that Montana has the highest suicide rate in the country, and that there's a strong association between suicide and alcohol and substance abuse in younger people. In the HHS committee, we're asked to strengthen Montana's suicide prevention law. While here, we seem determined to beat Montana's own record suicide rate. It's as if one hand giveth and the other taketh away. I have heard from many faculty and staff at MSU with concerns about an upset student who brings a concealed gun to class after a bad grade, or with some other hostile feeling towards the professor. I've also heard the concerns of law enforcement constituents who explain that when called to an active shooter scene, they'll be unable to distinguish the good guy from the bad guy, increasing, not decreasing, everyone's safety. As a practicing attorney for 25 years, I was involved in hundreds of murder cases. Many involved shootings by young people who were using drugs or alcohol and arose out of an unexpected situation where alcohol, youthful judgment, and easy access to guns combined to result in death of another. I've seen shootings by young people over a dispute over a girlfriend, a drug deal which went bad, or simply delusional thinking about somebody else. These types of shootings are infinitely more likely to occur with this bill. I've also seen firsthand the pain of a family felt after losing a child to suicide. A couple of years ago, as Bozeman's rabbi, I officiated at the funeral of a student who took his own life while away at University of Montana. I didn't sleep the night before because I knew that there was nothing I could say or do to offer healing or consolation to that, to his parents, to his younger siblings, or to the hundreds of friends who attended the funeral. There is no way that even the most talented clergy can offer meaningful comfort.
Representative Staffman, how much longer are you going to be? This is very long for an amendment speech.
20 seconds, Mr. Chair.
Okay, thank you.
I'm sure that all of us here can care deeply about providing a safe environment for our sons and daughters attending Montana's great universities. But increasing guns on our campuses will cause more death, not less, more suffering for Montana families, not less, more fears for faculty, staff, and law enforcement, not less, and all in the name of a need for self-defense, attested to by not a single witness in Montana. Mr. Chair, I move the amendment.
Thank you. And I apologize for interrupting, but usually amendments don't have a campaign speech to go with them. Questions? Representative Burgley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm going to resist this amendment. I think, as I made clear in my opening, that college campuses, gun-free zones in general, are the areas where mass shootings do take place. I think that it behooves us as legislators and as state officials to allow people their constitutional rights and not prohibiting them. The arguments that are being made for this bill are a preemptive idea of that people don't have the right to exercise rights because somebody may use those rights wrongly. That's not what this country was founded on. It's not what I believe. I don't believe it's what we believe as a majority party. I think personal responsibility still shines through. I think balancing the idea of the possibility of risk and people making poor decisions, I don't think it's the right or the authority of the legislature to be controlling people's lives and making decisions on what people may or may not do. I think it is the right of the legislature to ensure that people have the right to defend themselves and not removing a right from the people of Montana, the students that attend Montana State University or University of Montana or any of the other colleges to protect themselves. And it has been shown over and over and over again, and I would challenge any member of this body to find me a situation where a mass shooter has been engaged by an armed individual and then has gone on to kill multiple more people. It doesn't exist. As I also brought up in my testimony, the cases of the two churches in Texas, one had no armed security inside and one did. The one that did not, 24 people were killed, another 20 were wounded. The one that did, 2 people were killed and 1 person was wounded. It's been shown over and over that mass shootings only happen in areas where people are not allowed to defend themselves. Law enforcement is at a minimum, on statistical averages, it takes them twice as long to respond to a mass shooting as it actually takes. So I think we owe it to people, the university students, to have the ability to defend themselves and to express themselves and to take responsibility for their own actions. Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Tannenbaum.
Sorry, I lowered my hand. I don't have a question.
That's fine. Any further? The only thing I'll say is I actually did, when I was a police officer, work at University of Maryland. We had 50,000 people a day come to that campus, actually 50,000 students, and then on top of that you had all the staff and professors. And I can tell you, based on the amount of officers we had versus the amount of officers that actually our universities only have three campuses that actually have sworn police officers on the campuses. MSUB has less than 10, and the other two, Missoula and Bozeman, have in their teens. I don't think that that's sufficient. And if you look at the other campuses like Montana Tech and the other campuses, they do not have sworn officers at all. They have unarmed security guards. They probably concern me a little bit more than the ones that actually do have sworn police officers, but you have no protection at the other campuses at all. So that's probably my bigger concern when it comes to the universities. But Representative Kelker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a question for the sponsor, please.
Representative Burgley.
Mr. Chair, Representative Kelker.
Mr. Chair, Representative Burgley. I have been looking at some information about campuses that are treated the way your bill is set up. And one of the things that surprised me is that the campuses that have this kind of law had to spend a lot of money in setting up the program.
Representative Kelker, I've been told
being it. Being safe. Like millions and millions of dollars. Do you have any idea of what the cost would be to the university system here if this bill were to pass?
Mr. Chair, Representative, I would say the cost would be near zero. If the university system wants to increase their on-campus security, I think that should be done to protect the students, not to protect against the students. I think the idea is now is that any person at any time can bring a gun into any area of the Montana University system if they so choose. And I would argue that there probably are many people. I have acquaintances that I've known throughout my years that have carried on campus, especially after school shootings. Montanans are extremely independent, self-reliant, responsible people. And there are people that have weighed the cost of being charged with a crime for carrying against their personal safety and the safety of others. And I know of people that have carried guns concealed on campus. The idea is not that we're introducing guns to campus, it's that we're giving people a legal avenue to do so. It's up to the campuses if they want to increase their security. And the arguments that have been made that for increased costs to regulate or control against the carrying of firearms, to me, is a red herring that is stating that universities will then have to regulate and restrict people from certain areas to prevent guns from being in there. Guns don't kill people. People kill people. And the idea is that if you look across the board at the hundreds of thousands of concealed carry permit holders or just people that carry concealed permanent or period, there's a lot of states that allow permitless carry. The instances of those people actually killing people accidentally are basically zero. You have an occasional person, you know, nationwide, you're talking about millions of people that carry and basically no instances. Statistically, people that carry concealed have a much lower rate of accidents than even police officers do. So if we're going to let police on our campus, we should let people on our campus that have been proven to be even safer. Firearms don't inflict harm on people without people taking an action. So I don't believe that there would be any increased cost to our universities, Mr. Chair.
Representative Ferris Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a comment. I'll be supporting this amendment because it resolves the constitutional issue that we saw in the legal note. I think Article 10, Section 9A, if I'm right, talks about how the Board of Regents has control over the university system. And while I certainly appreciate that both Heller and McDonald reaffirmed the right to carry firearms and the right to self-defense, both of those were specific to self-defense in the home. And so while I believe we have the right to carry firearm, I don't believe the right to carry firearms overrides the right of the Board of Regents to control the university system. So I will be supporting the amendment to resolve that constitutional issue.
Representative Staffman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd just like to respond to legislature not be controlled these. Agree with him.
Representative Staffman, we're having some issues with your internet.
Okay, let me.
It sounds like it's a little bit better, but if it continues.
Is that better?
Yes.
Okay. I wanted to respond to Representative Burgley about the legislature shouldn't be controlling these rights, and I actually agree with him. And playing off of what Representative Ferris Olson just said, it should be the Board of Regents. They are the ones best suited to make these decisions with respect to the safety of our students and our faculty and our staff. Secondly, Mr. Chair, with respect to your concerns and remarks, I want to say that I've been told by local law enforcement that they can be to a shooting scene on the campus in just a matter of minutes. And they are the ones who expressed to me the concern that when they get there and there's multiple people with guns, they don't know who the good guys and the bad guys are. And everybody is assumed to be a bad guy. And so this creates another serious safety problem. And that's not coming from me, but from local law enforcement. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Keyes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, we all took an oath day one to uphold the U.S. and Montana constitutions. My U.S. Constitution on the Second Amendment says shall not be infringed. It doesn't say, oh, if the Board of Regents disagrees, then we can infringe this. If you read Montana's Constitution, right, the bare arms, it uses similar language, shall not be called into question. There's absolutely nothing in the oath we took that says the Board of Regents has the authority over us and our guns. We have authority on our guns, and they do not. So I totally support. I will not support this amendment, but I do support the bill. Thank you.
Representative Gillette.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just really briefly, I think the suicide argument is very compassionate. I understand it. I just wanted the committee members to know that when you look at the totality of the scientific evidence, so you don't cherry pick studies that are convenient for you, and you objectively analyze them, it actually turns out that states with permissive gun laws actually have no changes in suicide or homicide rates, and in fact, in some instances, they improve. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
Question.
The question was called, but I'll pipe in real quick with my only comment about the Heller. I believe that it does pertain to this because if you live on campus, that is your home. I believe so much so that they're getting driver's license, registering to vote, and using that address. That is their home. So if they do own guns, they have nowhere else to take them anyway. So with that said, the question was called. We'll do a roll call vote on Amendment HB 102.1.4.
Vice Chair Regeer?
No.
Vice Chair Kelker?
Yes.
Representative Carlson?
No.
Representative Stromswald?
No.
Representative Burgley?
No.
Representative Phelan?
No.
Representative Fleming?
No.
Representative Staffman?
Yes.
Representative Lenz?
Nay.
Representative Gillette?
No.
Representative Lear?
No.
Representative Tenenbaum?
Yes.
Representative Bishop?
Yes.
Representative Hinkle?
No.
Representative Hawk?
Yes.
Representative Skies?
Nay.
Representative Ferris Olson?
Yes.
Representative France?
He said yes via thumbs up.
Chair Usher?
No.
Amendment fails 12 to 7.
Amendment failed. Back to the bill as amended. Vice Chair Regeer.
Mr. Chair, I move that House Bill 102 pass as amended. That's twice amended.
Discussions on the original amended bill? Representative Lentz?
Mr. Chair, I call the question.
Question's been called. Roll call vote.
Vice Chair Regeer?
Yes.
Vice Chair Kelker?
No.
Representative Carlson?
Yes.
Representative Stromswald?
Yes.
Representative Burgley?
Aye.
Representative Phelan?
Yes.
Representative Fleming?
Yes.
Representative Staffman?
No.
Representative Lenz?
Aye.
Representative Gillette?
Yes.
Representative Lear?
Yes.
Representative Tenenbaum?
No.
Representative Bishop?
No.
Representative Hinkle?
Yes.
Representative Hawk?
No.
Representative Skies?
Aye.
Representative Ferris Olson?
No.
Representative France?
No.
Chair Usher?
Yes.
Motion passes 12 to 7.
House Bill 102 passes. Judiciary. This closes the hearing for House Bill 102. Open the hearing for House Bill 124. Vice Chair Regeer.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 124 to pass.
Questions from the committee? Discussion? Representative Skies.
Mr. Chair, I call the question.
Oh.
Questions?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Hinkle.
Passed here. So 124, I may have some amendments on that if we could hold off on executive action. Mr. Chair, I make a substitute motion to table.
It's not debatable. We have a substitute motion to table. It's not debatable. The only thing that's debatable is if I do a roll call or a voice vote. We'll do a voice vote. All in favor to table House Bill 124, say aye.
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 All opposed, say no.
No.
Nay.
No, so we'll do a roll call vote.
Vice Chair Regeer?
Yes.
Vice Chair Kelker?
No.
Representative Carlson?
No.
Representative Stromswald?
No.
Representative Burgley?
Yes.
Representative Phelan?
No.
Representative Fleming?
No.
Representative Staffman?
Yes.
Representative Lenz?
Aye.
Representative Gillette?
Yes.
Representative Lear?
Yes.
Representative Tenenbaum?
No.
Representative Bishop?
No.
Representative Hinkle?
Yes.
Representative Hawk?
No.
Representative Skies?
Yes.
Representative Ferris Olson?
He said no. Sorry. By... There he goes.
Representative France?
No.
That was a no.
That was a no.
Chair Usher?
No.
Motion fails 8 to 11.
Motion fails 8 to 11. So we're back on the bill.
Call for Vice the question.
Chair, Vice Chair Regeer.
Mr. Chair, I move that House Bill 124 do pass.
Thank you. Representative Kelker?
Call for the question.
Oh. Question's been called. Roll call vote.
Vice Chair Regeer?
Yes.
Vice Chair Kelker?
Yes.
Representative Carlson?
I'm sorry, Mr. Chair. I don't know what we're voting on right this second.
We're voting on House Bill 124.
Do pass?
Do pass.
Okay. Yes.
Representative Stromswald?
Yes.
Representative Burgley?
Yes.
Representative Phelan?
Yes.
Representative Fleming?
Yes.
Representative Staffman?
No.
Representative Lenz?
Aye.
Representative Gillette?
Yes.
Representative Lear?
Yes.
Representative Tenenbaum?
No.
Representative Bishop?
No.
Representative Hinkle?
No.
Representative Hawk?
No.
Representative Skies?
Aye.
Representative Ferris Olson?
No.
Representative France?
No.
Chair Usher?
Yes.
Motion passes 12 to 7.
House Bill 124 passes. Close the hearing for House Bill 124. Does anybody have anything else for the good of the order? Representative Hinkle.
Mr. Chair, I think we're moving a little bit fast here, personally. I had some discussion to make, and there was no discussion. Couldn't table the bill. So it might be nice if we slowed down a little bit, looked around a little bit. Some of us might have some stuff to say. Thank you.
I appreciate that comment. This is House Judiciary, and we just went 25 minutes, actually 45 minutes over my promise to all of the people on the committee that we would get out by 11:45 for lunch. So I would not say that we're running too fast. Representative Skies.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a point of clarification for the new folks in the committee. All these that we just passed, you don't need to put them back in your folder because they're no longer in the committee. I would suggest bringing them with you to the House floor so that when they do get moved on the floor, you have a source of reference of what was discussed. If anybody asks you specifically about the bill, you can have this as a reference. Once it passes the floor, you can get rid of these folders because you'll find out real quick these folders become huge in judiciary. And then second point, Mr. Chair, I want to apologize. I know I'm a rule monger and I've read this way too much. My role in the committee is to be a support to you as the chair and the vice chairs, and I don't want to be an impediment to the process and to remind everybody that if we just do it and nobody objects, it becomes the rule. So I don't want to be an impediment based on my knowledge of the rules in the committee. I totally support the chair and what he wants to do. I just want to make sure that's said.
Any further? This closes judiciary, House Judiciary.